Here I am. Dr. Professor Peter Ward is my guest. Fascinating program. We're talking about life elsewhere, and we're talking about life here. Aliens elsewhere, aliens here. It's kind of a disconcerting conversation in a lot of ways. Don in Madison, Wisconsin writes, hey, Art, missed the first 11 minutes of the show. Why are you back in the Philippines and for how long? Well, we'll talk more about that on Friday, maybe forever. Who knows? We'll see. In a moment, we're going to drag things back to Earth, and there's plenty to talk about with regard to what's going on here on our own planet. It's pretty strange. I'll tell you all about it in a minute. It's a very strange summer here. We'll be right back. Professor Ward, let's come back to Earth for a moment. I'm, of course, here in the Philippines, and it's summertime here. Our summer is from, mid-late March until about June, what they've referred to as summer. And during the entire period, Professor, it's been cloudy. I could count perhaps 2 or 3 days in the entire period when we had anything relating to blue skies and sunshine. It has been one cloudy day after another. And the local media here, the television and the radio, are widely talking about global warming and the change in the global climate as a reason for it. That could be pure hogwash, but they're talking about that over here. And of course, they're worried about it because the Philippines is made up of 7,107 islands. And when you're on an island and, you know, people are talking about sea level rise and changes in climate, you worry a little bit. Any comments?
Yeah, well, I worry quite a bit myself. It doesn't do anybody any good to spout doom and gloom to the point that there's no hope. But look, we have 3 feet of sea level rise tied into the system right now. If we don't put another carbon dioxide molecule into the atmosphere, there's going to be a 3-foot rise just because the sea is warmed. 3 feet doesn't sound like much, but 3 feet up also means hundreds of feet of salt moving laterally into agricultural fields. That's the spooky part to me. If you start computing how much of the world's agricultural fields are at sea level, below sea level, or within 3 feet, it's really spooky because the deltas, like the Nile and the Ganges and the Mississippi, these are some of the biggest rice-growing areas on the planet. Mm-hmm. And 3 feet takes out every single delta on Earth.
Yeah, a lot of Americans don't understand how important rice is. It is a staple of the diet here and all over Asia, as a matter of fact. You don't have a meal without rice. And without rice, sometimes, for a lot of people, you don't have a meal. Yep. So it's serious stuff.
Yep.
And Professor, could there be anything to that? I mean, are we going through a change in our climate?
Yeah, I think absolutely we are. You could step back and say the climate is always changing, and so in one sense that's nothing unusual. On the other hand, if you look at historical records, the level of CO2, carbon dioxide, in our atmosphere now is equivalent to what it was somewhere between 20 and 30 million years ago. We haven't been this high in 20 to 30 million years, and very soon we will be back where we were 100 million years ago. During the age of dinosaurs, a very warm, warm climate. We have, within 100 to 150 years, a current increase, we will be back in the Cretaceous. Now, the Cretaceous was not a time of any ice sheets, let alone ice caps. Ice cap is something that floats on the sea. Ice sheet sits on land. If an ice cap melts, so what? If an ice sheet melts, up goes sea level.
Right. There are people who are saying that right now, the Antarctic ice is actually increasing, not decreasing. Is there any support for that?
Interestingly, I just have come back from Antarctica, my first trip ever.
Oh, lucky you! Yeah. That's the one place, the one continent I have not been to. And how was it?
Well, there were some moments when I was thinking I'm not very lucky at all. We had a storm on our third day that we were two parties, one from the American Museum of Natural History and our party, University of Washington and Caltech, and the big storm hit on the second, third day. The American Museum team was found in a cave just barely alive after the storm blew all their tents down. So if you don't have a tent in a big storm when it's below zero and you've got, we had 90-mile-an-hour winds, you die real fast. So they got evacuated by icebreaker. We survived that storm, but all the Antarctic hands kept saying they've never seen weather this severe. And the reason is you just warm it up a little bit. So to go back to your question, I had with me one of my colleagues is Eric Steig. He's a University of Washington professor like me, but he had the cover of Nature about 4 months ago, the most prestigious journal of all, showing that Antarctica is warming. I mean, this is the last hope for anti-global warming skeptics. Antarctica's been cooling, they say. No, now they can show that every continent is warming, and warming rapidly. There is 240 feet of sea level rise in the ice on Antarctica. We cannot let that melt.
Wow.
Yeah, 240 feet.
My gosh. Where were you in Antarctica?
Antarctic Peninsula. We were... The long string of islands stick out. So we didn't go through McMurdo. We went down from Chile, a place called Punta Arenas, and took a ship, an icebreaker, 5 days across the Drake Passage, got dumped off, seven of us, with our tents, and picked up 6 weeks later.
Wow. The purpose of your trip?
Fossil hunting. We're looking at mass extinctions of the past, and just coincidentally, we're watching ice sheets, just as amateurs, not as professionals. We were doing fossil collecting as professionals. But our camp was on permafrost, which was no longer perma. So we were on these, it's just this muddy mess where it's supposed to be frozen solid. It's very, it's changing very fast according to those who know it.
Well, of course, that is a great danger because we've got the Ross ice shelf there. And if, as you point out, if an ice shelf goes...
Yeah.
Then the sea level rise really does begin in earnest, and that's scary stuff.
Absolutely.
And if you were on an island, as I am now, would you be concerned, or is it still far enough in the future that you'd shrug it off?
Yeah, it's not in our lifetimes. I've been to the Philippines. I very much enjoyed it. I've been to Manila, been to Negros, Dumaguete City. And it's, as you know, it's a high island. There's plenty of high levels there. It's not like Nauru or the Bahamas, for heaven's sake. The Bahamas are just like low sand hills. So the volcanic islands, the high islands, are fine. But near the ends of our lives, I hope to live to 200 years in age, and I hope to do too, but near the ends of our lives, we will start seeing this acceleration of sea level, and it will be scary and spectacular.
Huh. How long, looking far ahead, Professor, can we expect that there will be animal life on Earth?
Yeah, we're going to actually have a long time, and that's what's so strangely ironic about this whole business I'm in. The short-term danger is too much carbon dioxide. The long-term danger for all animals on this planet is not enough carbon dioxide. And that kind of goes to the heart of this book I just wrote, the Medea hypothesis, that life has done this. Life is shortening the time on which life could be on the planet. That sounds circular, but it's not. Life is ultimately its own worst enemy.
All right. Let me interject this because it's something I read in the first hour. We are now in this really bizarre solar minimum.
Yep.
There's just virtually nothing going on in the sun. And by this time, ham operators like myself and those who study the sun expected we would be well into a new solar, on our way to a new solar maximum. It hasn't happened. The sun is just dead. Dead quiet. And there are many who believe, and we'll find out if you're one of them, that the action on the sun ultimately affects the climate here on Earth. And it does seem a reasonable hypothesis that it would be so. Are you one of those people or no?
Well, I mean, who could deny that the sun affects climate? And all we need to look at are the fact that the Earth goes around in an ellipse, not a circle, and that the great Milutin Milankovitch was the one who showed that these three aspects of orbit totally affect climate. The fact that we went into ice age, out of ice age, into ice age, is all about where you are in those orbital parameters. Sometimes you're closer to the sun every year, sometimes you're farther away every year. So just even a minimal change in our distance really radically changes weather. Now, the longer term, is the sun fluctuating in the energy output? I mean, that's what we're really looking at, isn't it? Do we have
Yes, it is.
With more energy and less energy? And the trouble is our observation, we've observed sunspots over long periods of time, but we're just getting to the point where we're getting sophistication in understanding energy output. We don't have a 1,000-year record, and yet maybe some of these cycles are 2,000, 10,000, 15,000 years. We don't know yet. We just don't know yet.
Okay, well, here's the thing. The last time we had a solar minimum that looked kind of like this one, when the sun just became dead for a long period of time, we had a mini ice age. Now, perhaps that's coincidence, and perhaps not. If not, and if there really is a relationship between climate and the action on the sun, which again seems reasonable, then we're at an interesting juncture in Earth's history in that we're producing so much greenhouse gas right now, and beginning to have arguments with ourselves about the wisdom of continuing to do so. And right now, it would seem as though we're beginning to make, or at least beginning to make intelligent changes in that direction. But if the sun remains quiet, and if that means another sort of mini ice age or a cooling on the planet, then it's absolutely going to crush the arguments of those who would like to stop the greenhouse emissions, or at least, you know, slow them down. And there's always a possibility that once the sun finally does become active again, you know, we've sort of gone on emitting these gases because, well, it's the economic thing to do. And then all of a sudden the sun gets active, and then we get this incredible spike in global warming. Yes?
Yeah, it's very scary, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is.
If we're now dealing with the quiet time where the sun is minimizing the output and we're still getting warmer, I mean, you just read the Riot Act for what we ought to be doing in terms of at least slowing down greenhouse gases. Now, there are those, many you know, who say that greenhouse gases have nothing to do with global temperature and that it's all the sun. And yet, how could we have these measurable increases in temperature during quiet sun time if it's the sun? So the arguments that greenhouse gas have nothing to do with it, I think, fall apart right there.
Well, I know there's going to be a lot of brouhaha about this, but I think most scientists now consider global warming to be a settled science. In other words, it's not, among real scientists, there's not that much argument anymore about it, is there?
No, there's none. Really, the people who argued against it are people like the senator from Oklahoma who have axes to grind. It reminds me so much of the smoking battles of the 60s and 70s where they would get doctors to stand up and say, oh, smoking's good for you.
I know.
No, so that part's what we don't know is the ultimate effect of how fast things will happen. And that's where people look at the legitimate doubts on rates and seem to construe that as there are fights about whether or not it's happening. It's happening. How fast it happens, when and where, that stuff's all up in the air still.
Well, again, if we do get a sort of a small ice age, and if it actually cools for a while because of the sun, it's going to make the argument for global warming very difficult once again. And it seems to me that laws will relax, regulations will relax, will begin emitting, and then away we go when the sun gets active. So, you know, how much of a possibility do you think that if the sun remains calm, that we'll actually get some cooling as a result of it?
None to me. And the reason I say that is I've just spent a lifetime dealing with past climate. So, interestingly enough, NASA came to myself and about 10 other people about 4 weeks ago and said, we are really worried about future climate change, and you know, we've ignored deep time. We just have never looked at the deep time phenomena to understand, could this have anything to say about future climate? And absolutely. I mean, you go back in the past, we can measure past carbon dioxide levels. We can then look at the record of the animals and the plants. We can tell you, was it a hot world or a cold world? We can tell you if there was ice or no ice based on certain carbon dioxide levels. There has never been ice at 1,000 parts per million CO2. That's three times what we have now. We're heading there. We're heading within 200 years at most to a world where there has never been ice with that CO2 level. I mean, the sun has, if it's part of this, the rock record doesn't tell us. The rock record says absolute fidelity between CO2 and past global temperatures.
Well, a few years ago, my eyes went wide open. I think they put up a satellite picture of the North Pole 10 or 20 years ago. I can't recall what it was. And then a recent satellite photograph of the North Pole. And that's the scariest damn thing I've ever seen. 40-50% of the North Pole is now melted?
Yeah, it's going, gone. Well, the Great Northwest Passage, it's there now. All those people, the Franklin Expedition, they all died trying to find it. Well, they find it now.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about where we as human beings will go. If this change is inevitable, and it sure looks that way, this continued warming, human beings have evolved through time, through climate changes and all the rest of it. We've evolved. Is there any chance, in your opinion, Professor, that we would evolve to be able to survive in a changed and changing climate?
Well, I suspect so. We certainly have. We are, as Steve Stanley said, we are children of the Ice Age, and the Ice Age was nothing but change. You had glacial and the nasty cold everywhere, and interglacial back and forth. But to really produce a new species, if you want to evolve, you want to produce a new species, that's where most of the evolution takes place, we would have to separate somehow. If we head out in space, yes, I could expect new human species to arrive, but with transportation being what it is, and with social mores falling, with the taboos against breeding with other countries' people falling like crazy, the chance becomes less and less that some group of us could get isolated and have sufficient isolation, sufficient change around them to produce huge evolutionary differences. I mean, the evolution we're doing now is over two things only. It's over the food we're eating, and it's the fact that we evolved not to be in groups, but to be solitary pretty much. And now we live in cities, and we're just being hammered by diseases. And we human species were never meant to be in cities. And so evolution we see is against disease, and it's for all this new food we're eating.
Well, here's an interesting, perhaps semi-relevant point. I have three kitty cats. Two of them are from North America, from, you know, that are brought over here from North America. One is a Filipino cat. And all the cats here in the Philippines have very short hair. And our little Filipino cat has very short hair. The two I brought from North America have very long hair. I guess that was evolution's way of saying, here, have a bunch of fur and stay warm. You live in a cold climate. And the short hairs here live in a very warm climate, so they don't need all that hair. Human beings, on the other hand, don't have hair, most of us, and we're not really equipped to be in a warmer climate than we're in right now, and I can't imagine how we would evolve, and maybe you can imagine, how would we evolve to live in a normally much warmer climate than we have at the moment?
Yeah, I don't think we can. I mean, we are already as hairless as we can be. I think we did come from a very tropical place. And the only way you could do it, really, is to evolve to be even taller and skinnier. I mean, you can get rid of heat that way. If you're short and round, it's much harder to get rid of heat. You can reduce your fat content, but the reality is that it would be very hard for us. On the other hand, any sort of technology helps you get out of that. You build an air conditioner. Evolution only works if people die on huge numbers. Organisms have to die, and then you can spur evolution. We save everybody. I mean, nobody dies anymore, essentially, not from the diseases, not from the stuff that used to kill you, not from the predators. They don't get us anymore. So right. Evolution is really stopped in many respects.
Isn't that awfully dangerous for us? I mean, if we find ways, at least temporarily, around a problem like global warming, because we have air conditioning or whatever else keeps us cool, then we fail to evolve if there was, in fact, a way to evolve. All right. Evolve. Peter Ward, Professor Peter Ward is my guest. We're talking about what's going on here on Mother Earth. I'm Art Bell. A lot of fast blasting in its truest form Good to hear you, Art. Global warming is the 21st century boogeyman. Cannot be convinced otherwise. Or David in Ball Ground, Georgia. Global warming is not settled science. My God, you lemmings. Geologically, arming events preceded CO2 rise by 800 years. Explain that one. Let's see. Had to turn the program off tonight. Couldn't stand the idiocy of you two keep preaching global warming, despite the fact the Earth has been cooling for the past 10 years. Never mind the facts. We must keep the propaganda going. Pathetic. And so I knew there'd be a lot of that, because there's a lot of that out there, more than all of you understand. I would say by percentage, probably about 30% or so of people, the minute you mention global warming, get actually angry. It's an interesting phenomenon, even though really the science is pretty much settled. Honestly, it is. If you look at the gigantic majority, probably up 90% or better of the scientists who study it, it is settled science. It is warming. But it makes people angry, and it's worth examining a little bit about why they get angry. They get angry because it threatens them. They might have to change the way they live. They might have to become a little greener. They might have to drive something other than they're driving. They might have to segregate their trash. They might have to do this and that. And so it makes them angry. That's I believe, the reason for the anger. People don't like change. They hate change, and they hate being told that they're doing the wrong thing, or that what they're doing is harming the planet. So I think that's the reason for the anger. I understand that if we go into a cooling period, if we actually, as a result of the sun, go into a period of cooling, even an ice age, that these people are then going to be armed with all kinds of ammunition to have whatever limits, laws, and regulations we have in place right now removed, and plow ahead with polluting the atmosphere as we wish. Just imagine what that would do. Professor Peter Ward back in a moment. Well, all right, Professor Peter Ward. Professor, the Gaia hypothesis says, and it takes us right back where we were going earlier, that life makes the Earth optimal, or the Earth may be alive, right? Even maintain some of them that Earth is alive. But you, Professor, advocate that life anywhere is inherently suicidal. The Medea, you mentioned it, Medea hypothesis. Is life crazy and needs to get locked up like suicidal patients, or are you the one that needs to be locked up, Professor?
Nah, probably a little bit of both. I didn't put, is life suicidal? The book company did that. What I tried to do was write a book on what's the far future going to do for this planet? How long do we have to go? What's going to happen to us? And what is it about the deep past that informs the future? So it really is a take on how long do we have on this planet before habitability runs out, before we have to go somewhere else? I mean, we have two choices. The sun's going to keep getting brighter and brighter and brighter. There's no stopping that. So our choice is to either engineer our way out of the brighter, brighter, brighter somehow, or move. I mean, that's the two choices. So I try to do a balanced view of this. I try to take a good look at what is the far future. We get so caught up in this near future, and it's really a much more fascinating question. We can predict the far future better than the near future. The global warming, whether it's going to get hot, whether it's going to get cold, if we have a glaciation starting or not, and that's what seems to consume us, where far more interesting conjectures are the longer term. But you say, well, I mean, who's going to be around to see it? Species last a long time. We have the sort of, I think, species guilt, thinking, oh, we're bad, you know, we've done this, we've done that, and therefore maybe we'll die off soon. No, I think we're going to be around for a very long time, and that our species will have to come to grips with some very long-term solutions to planet Earth.
It sounds like you might have moved away from the telephone a little bit, Professor.
Oh, not there. The telephone fell off my... There we go. How's that?
Very much better, thank you. Did you know there was actually a NASA... I'm not sure what you would call it. A NASA idea, I guess, that they were rattling around, suggesting that perhaps with global warming, that one solution might be to change the orbital path of a large body, whether it be whatever it might be, some sort of asteroid or comet or something, and cause it to pass very close by to Earth thereby moving Earth, I know it sounds crazy, moving Earth farther away from the sun until we get global warming under control. It seemed like a crazy idea then and now, but it is, it was a real idea at NASA. What do you think?
Yeah, I've heard about this, and you're right. It is a real idea. It's a way to move the Earth farther away from the sun. However, I use this example, actually, in my public talks, and I tell people, do you want the government to have to throw, it's not just one, you'd have to throw thousands to millions of asteroids at the Earth, a near miss. And every time there's a near miss, it goes around the Earth, it jerks us a little bit further out into space.
Right.
So you don't, it's a government operation. If you screw up once, bang. So I'm not sure I would trust the government to do it, but the physics is correct.
So it would actually be possible.
Yep, it would work. But even a crazier idea has been put forward by Paul Crutzen, who won a Nobel Prize in chemistry. And this past year, he has suggested that unless we get our act together to cool the planet somehow, he proposes injecting sulfur into the high atmosphere, just what volcanoes do. Imagine Mount Pinatubo, which really changed the atmospheric content, the changed climate on the Earth for a year. And that was one Philippine volcano. Let's make airplanes be thousands of volcanoes and seed the atmosphere. It'll cool us off. But the crazy.
Could we actually do that? Do we actually have the.
Yes. Well, it could be done. Sure. The trouble is, what it does, it cools the Earth because the air becomes less transparent, but it also reduces your crops because you don't have as much light hitting the crops, and it causes the oceans to get even more acid, and they're already very acid. This is a crazy, crazy crackpot solution.
I see. And then what if you wanted to remove the sulfur from the upper atmosphere at some point? Could you do that?
You'd have to let it gently float out and also produce a huge amount of acid rain. So the rain goes through it, converts it to acid rain, it washes out. So you've cooled the Earth, but you've also acidified almost all the lakes and oceans on the planet. And you've murdered a lot of people because they've run out of food.
Are there any viable, important word, viable ideas, in your opinion, to cool the Earth if we have to? I mean, technology is one thing that I suppose could save our butts if it came to it. Is there any viable way to do it?
Yeah, there is. And I mentioned this to one of my undergraduate classes, and it looked at me like I was totally insane. A recent study has suggested that 10% of U.S. power is being used up by flat-screen TVs and iPods.
10% of U.S. 10%.
Power. Just, I said, get rid of your iPods and your flat screens, and you will do a whole lot for cooling the Earth. And they go, well, not those. So, yeah, the simplest thing is certainly just reducing the power plants. It's not automobiles. It's the power plants that make automobiles. I've heard that there are about 1 in 100 Chinese and Indians who own cars. They want cars.
Yeah.
Building the power plants to build the cars is why China and India are building coal-fired plants. And all that coal goes somewhere. And it is probably the greatest single problem we have now are all the new coal-fired plants all around the world.
Why aren't we going to nuclear facilities?
You know, that's a great question. I certainly have advocated that in a couple of my talks, and I got booed off one stage. And yet,
well, everybody right away, Professor, brings up the waste problem. You know, they're ready to ship it all to Yucca. And but I keep hearing that, you know, France and other areas of Europe are managing to recycle this stuff successfully. And if they can do it, I keep wondering why we can't.
Well, it's not a zero-sum game. There certainly are going to be accidents down the road. And look at Chernobyl. That's a total mess. But that's, again, that's a different species. That wasn't a waste problem. That was just a
disaster
maintenance problem, if you will. Disaster.
Well, it was a single-dome affair. It wasn't very well done. And, you know, it is fair to say, of course, we had Three Mile Island, but, I mean, we really haven't had a Chernobyl-type disaster in the United States or anywhere else in the world, for that matter. That was the one big one. And, you know, there's a certain case to be made that Nuclear plants are reasonably safe. Again, the big problem is the waste, and it's being dealt with in Europe. Why not here or there?
Great question. I can't answer that. Great question.
We've got to have the power.
We do have to have the power. Do we need as much power as we have, though? Conservation really could make a big dent in this. It can't solve all of it. It's not going to be any single solution. But conservation has to be one. We have to increase nuclear. We have to conserve. And we simply need to increase the alternate forms of energy that are out there. Wind and tidal energy is the one that I really like. Where I live in Puget Sound, we have these great big tidal surges. You simply put floats that go up and down and up and down, and you're creating electricity.
Right. I don't know if you're doing it in sufficient quantities. Solar power certainly appears to be becoming more and more viable. All of this, but nuclear plants do seem the way to go. It's just that everybody's so frightened of them that we don't do it. We're going to have to do something, and we're going to have to do it pretty soon. If you're going to ask people to give up their flat screens, then you might as well contemplate the end of the world. They're
okay.
Not going to do it.
I've done both.
Okay, well, so there are ways that Earth could be cooled. It could be done. Technology could save us.
I think technology will have to save us. And again, in this book, I argue that we need to engineer our way out of these things. That the Gaia hypothesis says that if we simply go back to nature, nature will take care of us. That's pretty naive. We need to understand that there are 6.5 billion of us, that we would like to reduce that population. I don't see it happening anytime soon. And therefore, unless you have some huge global disaster that wipes out a lot of people, which doesn't seem in the offing, we got a lot of mouths to feed. And the only way to do that is through technology. You just have to sort of suck it up and say, you know, this is the hand we're dealt. Let's do the best to cause the least misery out there that we can.
What have we got, about 6.5 billion now?
6.5 billion, and we're expected to have 9 billion between 2050 and 2075, if current projections continue.
What kind of numbers, in your opinion, mark the not sustainable point?
Well, I suspect 6.5 isn't sustainable, at least with current technology. But the hope is, that we talked earlier about aliens being built on Earth. Yeah, that type of technology, I think, is going to be the sort of engineering that I think we need. And the two things that kind of engineering can do for you is increase fuel output. We can start building hydrocarbons instead of digging them out of the earth. And secondly, food production, human food production, not at the level of killing cows and eating cows, but of growing algae in vast lakes at low levels, bacterial, if you will. May not taste good, but it will certainly sustain you. And if we get around the food and fuel problems, a lot of the problems are far less.
Your hypothesis states that it was life, not asteroids, from space that caused all of the mass extinctions, save the dinosaur kill-off. And that's quite a statement to make. What evidence do you have that supports that?
Well, we've been looking at these mass extinction boundaries for a long time. Again, I was just reacting to this whole Gaia. Gaia was Mother Earth, and the meanest Greek mother of all was named Medea. She was Jason's wife, Jason of the Argonauts. She got so mad at her very bad, philandering husband that she murdered their kids. And if you look back at this Earth history, these mass extinctions, which were the greatest murder events in the history of the planet, were caused by bacteria. One was caused by asteroids. The dinosaurs died in asteroids, but 14 other times in Earth history, it was microbes producing hydrogen sulfide gas, toxic H2S, which caused the mass extinctions. The evidence is written in the rocks. You find there's biomarkers, there's chemical signatures. We are getting better and better at figuring out past microbial assemblages, and all evidence seems to say the asteroids are no longer implicated in mass murder.
I've never been one to believe that Earth is actually alive, but my belief system, and it's just mine, says that Mother Nature doesn't get angry, she just gets even. In other words, when there become too many people on the earth for nature to support us and things get so far out of balance, then, you know, a little microbe or something is issued that straightens all that out by taking out half of the people on the planet or something. And so I guess that kind of fits in with what you're saying?
Yeah, it could be. The Gaia hypothesis king himself, a man named James Lovelock, really smart guy, and he was the person who first figured there couldn't be life on Mars because the atmosphere showed no evidence of life on Mars 10 years before the Vikings of the mid-70s. But then he moved on to believe that the Earth is alive, that the Earth is some giant superorganism.
Right.
And his point now is that of the 6.5 billion of us, there will only be a half billion left by the end of the century. Now, he doesn't say why. He just says that nature will do this little revision. I don't think so. My sense of it is that we're going to stay at high numbers. We're going to muddle through. There'll be a lot of misery. But that if we keep our smarts about us, if we believe in technology, try to save as much as we can, we'll get through this.
Well, I hope so. But I do kind of believe in this getting even thing. In other words, nature seems to have a way of balancing just about everything. When you look at predators and those that are chased and eaten, things do have a way of balancing out. If there's too many, I don't know, too many bunny rabbits, something comes along to eat a bunch of bunny rabbits. And that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about getting even, whether it's a microbe or something else. Something comes along to sort of, it seems like, even things out.
Well, it has in the past, but then nothing, anything like humanity has ever come along before. There's never been an intelligence like ours. Just the fact that when it's cold, we can put a coat on, I mean, that changes the whole dynamic. We can make the coat. My dog, I get this beautiful dog. I have a cat, too. I love my cat. But compared to us, they are dumb as sticks. I mean, they're wonderful creatures, but they're not going to be building radio telescopes. They're not going to be trying to expand to other planets. And they're not going to do the engineering solutions that we absolutely need to keep our species going. And not just going, but happily going. And you just said something, Art, just a minute ago. You say you hope, and hope is that operative word. If we don't keep that hope, what do we have? So our hope has to be through engineering. It has to be engineering solutions. It has to be producing lots and lots of new engineers in the upcoming generations.
In your book, Under a Green Sky, and again, this same hypothesis, Medea hypothesis, you suggest that not so far in our future, Earth's future, the oceans are going to actually turn purple and the sky is going to turn green and people will start being poisoned by hydrogen sulfide.
Yep, that will happen if we don't get our act together in terms of stopping this huge run-up in greenhouse gases, because it happened over and over in the deep past. And so this is kind of like the ghost of Christmas future in the Christmas Carol. This is the worst possible calamity that can happen if we do not somehow turn off this heating system that we're producing on the planet.
Purple ocean?
Purple oceans. I have a slide in my PowerPoint. You can go out to the Black Sea now. You throw a bucket over and pull it up from about 20 feet up, and the water is pure purple. There's a purple sulfur bacteria that lives only in no oxygen water with hydrogen sulfide.
And a green sky.
Green sky is coming up from sulfur compounds moving up into that blue sky. Nice yellow and blue makes green.
We're going to have to rewrite a whole lot of songs. Well, all right. Professor Peter Ward is my guest. Coming up this next hour, we'll take just a few moments, hit a couple of other topics, and then we're going to open the lines for Professor Ward. From the Philippines, I'm Art Bell.